Okay, let's go through this cryptic paragraph. Let me try to explain the basis of it, and it really, I think, does make sense to some extent, what he's saying, but also maybe not. Physics. We've talked about some of the new angles on understanding that quantum physics has been forced to come to grips with. And here's the basic issue, that if you take, let's take light, but because it shows the same behavior, but so do electrons. If you design a experiment in a certain way, you can prove that light is a particle. If you design an experiment in another way, you can prove light is a wave. Which is it? This is the great problem that quantum physics has uncovered. Now, apply that to electron. It's easier to see maybe if it's light. But under certain circumstances, an electron is a thing, behaves like a thing. Under other circumstances, it behaves like a wave. Well, how can a thing be a wave? Well, they don't know, but that's what the experimental results show. And what the group that Pauli worked with, the Copenhagen interpretation, that's what it was called, Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, what they said was that it's both. And that didn't bother them, that they felt that the nature of reality is determined by the experiment that investigates it. Now this, of course, you see, is revolutionary. Einstein could never accept this, by the way. In Newtonian physics, and as far as Einstein was concerned, there is something out there. And that they simply hadn't figured out how to figure out what that something was. Pauli felt that Einstein was just, you know, the old guy who couldn't come to terms with this new thing.
Yes. There is something out there. He couldn't accept that they're the same thing. How does that relate to there is something out there?
That what is out there apparently is determined by the way you look at it. That it's not objective, it's subjectively the case. And, but I think more important than that is that, you know, what is so annoying to the old scientists is that it puts a contradiction at the heart of science, where scientific methodology up to that point had been what disproves contradiction, what is certain. And now there's no more certainty. Now, I'm a little bit off on my deeper knowledge here. Maybe, Ted, maybe you know this. And not only did they do that, they could show there was a mathematical relationship between a degree of certainty knowing it one way and a degree of certainty knowing it another way. These weren't just accidents. There was a way to say, the more you can be certain to know it this way, the less you can be certain to know it that way, and the more you can be certain to know it that way, the less you can be certain to know it this way.
Yeah, and what that was the key indices, the position, and the momentum, which is movement and energy.
Right.
It's a measure of movement and energy, and if you measure one very precisely, then you're going to pay for it on
right.
the other.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right,
and in that there is an equation that actually says what those the multiplication of one uncertainty times another uncertainty is equal to this h.
It's Planck's constant.
Yeah, which is some kind of it's grown to be some kind of mystical constant.
You follow that? Remember Planck's constant? that was the lowest energy an electron could have. And electrons existed only in multiples of that energy. Remember, there wasn't a smooth gradation, there was this. Well, that blew their minds that these two uncertainties, when multiplied together, would equal Planck's constant. Your mind can't get around it. And Bohr said, anyone who feels they have understood quantum mechanics hasn't, because it is ununderstandable.
And that was repeated by this more modern guy, who thought to be the expert on quantum mechanics.
Feynman. Anyway, you don't have to worry about all those details. But what is important is, if we put that in psychological language, it enters into scientific thought the fact that a truth can contain two opposites. That isn't a indication of error. That's the big deal. Well, we've been talking about the split between Kepler and Fludd. And Pauli was simply saying in this paragraph I read you, because we've learned in science it is not unscientific to accept paradox as a statement of truth, that was opening the way to us accepting Kepler and Fludd as both being true. Which I think, so far so good, that's right. But then where do you go from there? That's the problem. But for him, quantum physics would intellectually pave the way for accepting Kepler and Fludd together. But it doesn't give him or us any practical way to do it. That's the problem. Because what's missing is the third term. Is this making sense? That what we're really looking for with Kepler and Fludd is a unity that's trying to be born. And that's the stranger, and that's Sophia.
So I'm both the Madonna and the whore.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they're animate. You're animate. Madonna and whore.
Yeah, and the man would be, what's the masculine version?
Where is it?
Christ and Satan, I guess.
Okay. And on 110, Pauli actually did get the third, because I still can't believe he said, like, such opposition won't allow healing through reasonable reflection or through coaching,
right,
but through a new experience.
Right.
So he, at one level, he catches it, and then...
Yep. There he's absolutely right.
110. It's the last indented paragraph, and it's the last sentence.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It reminds me of Jung's idea of the transcendent function. Which
exactly.
Hold the opposite long enough.
Exactly.
You're willing to hold the tension, which
right.
is really hard to do.
Right.
Until the new thing unfolds, and it might not ever unfold in your lifetime.
Absolutely.
You just have to be willing to hold it and pass it on.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you miss it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what it says down here at the bottom of 114. So ultimately, there is a tendency for my unconscious to take something away from psychology to relieve its burden. It couldn't carry.
And that's the beginning of the end between Jung and Pauli. That statement.
That statement right there.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that oftentimes what happens when something new is coming up,
mm-hmm.
that it falls back? And then it comes up again, and it's not mine until we get it.
Right. Unfortunately, it got him first. I think what Nancy says is right. This probably isn't to be solved in our generation, our lifetime. Who knows? But probably not. But it's like what we're being asked to do is ask the right question. And that's what he couldn't sustain and live with the contradiction. It's a big deal. And really, I think, this is what we are to give to the next generation. that we have asked the right question.
Somewhere that heard or read or whatever, that it can be that the unconscious, you know, tries to the point where it eventually gives up trying anymore. And that is when you would say that he died.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it gave up on him.
It gave up on him. Is that how you put it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you know, I don't want to sound cruel, but I feel the same way sometimes with people. You work and nothing happens. What am I doing this for? You know, it sounds cruel, but I get paid whether they get better or not. The unconscious feels the same way. Why should I keep busting my butt if they're not going to listen? And what I often notice is when I reach that state, so do their dreams. I'm just sick of you.
Oh, okay.
I was talking to a woman not too long ago, and I reached that point. I thought, you are wasting my time, and I'm just so sick of this bullshit that I'm listening to every hour. And I'm going to say something to you about this. But this has happened to me maybe 5 times in 30 years. And I'll be damned, she didn't come in, and she started off, and she said, well, we need to talk about something. I'm not taking this seriously.
Uh-huh.
But see, my affect was so in tune with herself that it knew when to be disgusted. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the self is. Mm-hmm. It just, now, thank God she could make that scene. We could talk about it. We could get somewhere. But, yes, I think that's what happens. The unconscious just checks out. After. I mean, it tries for years. And then it'll say, well, you know, I think I'll... It's like the great cosmic energy system says, I think I'll go somewhere else. You know? There's new kids being born every day. Why should I worry about you? You know, you're on your way anyway. Mm-hmm. It's cruel. It's absolutely cruel. And that's what Jung means by the cold-blooded aspect of the self. It, at some point, it just says, well, if you're not going to listen, I'll find somebody who will. I don't really care about you anymore. But as I said, it's In 30 years, I've probably seen it, maybe not even 5 times. And in several cases where I have said it, that woman actually said it first, the person said, I agree. That they knew somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they were character disorders who were hopeless.
Mm-hmm. Have you found those people have died?
Two have died. No, it was a marriage deal, and I know they're divorced. Mm-hmm. They're not from here, they're from... another town. And I was there lecturing at this other town, and this guy's wife came up and talked to me, and she said, we're divorced, and I'm happy.
So something died.
Something died. Yeah.
Okay.
But back to Nancy's point real quick. We don't know what this... by the way, what I just described in physics is called the complementarity principle. That it takes two apparently contradictory understandings to describe the nature of reality, to describe the nature of the electron. The electron is both a particle and a wave. That is a contradiction, but that is where we go. Now, is that the final story? Or is that two opposites which 200 years from now will be synthesized? We don't know. But it's exciting, I think. And again, for Pauli, that at least opened the door intellectually to accept Kepler and Flood. That it's okay, it is not unscientific to hold two contradictory explanations. Even today, I think, if you went to most scientists, quote-unquote, not real scientists, but the ones who think they're real scientists, and you said, well, we have to synthesize the Middle Ages and science, they laugh at you. Because they have this contradiction-less understanding of what science is. And what quantum mechanics opens the door to is it is not unscientific to entertain contradictions. I think that's a beautiful thing, personally.
you know, it's weird too, is people live contradictorily too. It's like, we're saying we can't accept contradiction.
And it opens the way for a methodology to be viable that takes account of the contradictions of human life. We don't have to have a consistent system, because that's if electrons aren't consistent, why should people be consistent? Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is exciting.
So he's learning the thought and his contradiction.
Yeah, he was flipping back and forth and not able to carry his own, in a way he was not able to carry the philosophical implications of his own physics. And that may be why the self was so vicious to him. It's like it said, you got it here, now why can't you get it over here? You have Kepler and Fluck, you have von Franz and a wife. Don't shy away from this.
What's the difference between being able to live with that contradiction and being apparently borderline? Because if you are flipping back and forth between the opposites or holding tension of the opposites, could that not be perceived as like borderline or an unstable personality?
Well, you wouldn't
identify.
You wouldn't identify with either opposite.
Okay.
Like Jung and Tony and Emma. He wasn't lying to Tony about Emma, and wasn't lying to Emma about Tony. And when it came time, you know, you probably heard me say this, the reason we're here and not in the university is when it came time for Jung to get an offer at the university to teach, University of Zurich. He taught the ETH, it's not the same. At the university to teach, they said to him, you can teach here if you keep Tony Wolf hidden. Now, borderline would have said, okay. He said, no, I'm not going to keep her hidden. And he didn't get the position. But he stayed true to that conflict. And you do both knowing neither one is complete. And you don't, in one state, deny the existence of the other state. I think that's probably the biggest. And as you can see, it presupposes an honest personality.
Mm-hmm. I think the great gift is, because I know for myself I hold these two states in my being, but I read about it. And no other people have done it. I have examples mm-hmm. of it. It's such a gift because you know you're not crazy.
Yeah.
Because you feel crazy.
Right.
And so I think about these people and I think, God, thank you. This, at least I don't think I was alive during that time. Maybe I was. But that I didn't have to go through this kind of pain.
Yeah.
I have books, lots of books and friends and that I can share this with. I think it would be very difficult.
I think for me this is one of Jung's contributions. Nobody else has said this before him. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know since, really, that this is generative. Mm-hmm. And this is the way to generativity. Mm-hmm. And there is something in you that is not simply caused by the past, but that's creating the future. It's a draw towards the future. And what's the nature of it? I don't know, he says. Who cares? We don't know what the nature of the electron is. Does that mean we say it doesn't exist? So you can really see how quantum physics and Jung really do start to support each other here. They're both exploring new dimensions of reality. And if we can accept it in physics, why can't we accept it in psychology? And I think that's the important part of what Pauli is saying here, at least in principle.
I love what James Hollis says. He says, the only thing you can be guaranteed if you stay this course is an interesting life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's true. You can't guarantee anything more than that, but your life will be very interesting.
Yes.
And it is.
Oh, I saw him across a wonderful quote by Thoreau in this regard. Do not be too moral. See if I get it right. Do not be too moral. Aim high above morality. Do not be simply good. Be good for something.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that beautiful? Same idea. you will make mistakes here, believe me. If I can. Do not be too moral. Aim high above morality. Do not be simply good. Be good for something.
Well, I mean, I always think of Answer the Job because, but you know, that's what he was describing there. God, oh.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. Definitely. And boy, you see, you can see who you're talking to when you say that. If God is this, then they think he can't be that. Mm-hmm. Why can't he be both?
Hollis also said, I don't know why I thought of that, but I love what he says about you can either have the choices between depression and anxiety. Choose anxiety because it at least makes your life interesting. But those are basically the choices.
Okay. You can take an antidepressant or you can...
Mm-hmm. And the lady who in the audience who said, but what if I just want to be happy? And he said, well, what if your soul really doesn't have that in mind for you? Like, oh, God. Okay.
Well, I'm glad he said it.
Yeah.
Well, what she said was, well, what am I, well, she says, I'm happy. Why should I care about this? And he said, well, maybe the purpose of your life
isn't to be happy. Yeah.
And that maybe you're making other people unhappy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, now the beginning of the end starts slowly. He says, so ultimately there is a tendency for my unconscious to take something away from the psychology to relieve its burden. Under the influence of the flow of unconscious contents directed away from psychology, future development must entail such an extension of physics, possibly together with biology, so that the psychology of the unconscious can become part of its development. Now, what he means literally there is he thinks that physics is going to grow and provide the tools for uniting physics and psychology. That's what he's saying consciously. But I think what we can read into it is he can't stand the burden of interpreting his material psychologically. And we'll see this just evolve. This is just the beginning. Where it comes to, just as well, actually, we're getting there right there now, so I'm not jumping the gun too much. But Pali didn't want to interpret his dreams about physics psychologically. He thought, and I don't think he's wrong to a certain extent, that science is in evolution and that we're going to get new clues about how science can evolve in our dreams, and that he as a physicist is a candidate for receiving this. So his dreams are not about him, they're about physics. And Jung said, your dreams are both about physics and about you. And that's the end of that friendship. To make it piddles down. But that's the beginning of the end. But I think what I would say is that Pali couldn't stand the burden of interpreting his physics dreams psychologically. Now he will complain, we'll see him complain in a minute, that Jungians are a bunch of idiots and they're not really concerned about physics. But von Franz reports that, you know, he brought these dreams to her. And she said, you know, now explain to me what this concept in physics is so we can work through it. And he said, what do you think? You're going to get a free physics lesson?
Oh, God. Oh.
Meanwhile, she wasn't charging him for the hours.
Oh, what a jerk.
What a jerk. And then he will complain that Jung and the Jungians don't understand and can't help him with these themes. So, welcome again to a complicated and self-defeating personality. But I think it's particularly relevant. I think this is perhaps the way to the solution of the problem that he poses, unconscious. Remember, this all started when he said, what's gone wrong? Why Hiroshima and Nagasaki? And I think the unconscious has given him up to now one answer, and it's beginning to give him another. One answer is science must somehow evolve, in the long term, of course, to where the stranger and Sophia, the Chinese woman, where that point of view can be embodied. I think that's one answer. The other answer is that scientists now have a tool for working with their dreams, both as, like an artist does, inspiration for their work, and as a metaphor for something in either their own personal personality or the personality of the time. And Pauli wouldn't accept the first, and he will not accept the second either. So he's getting answers, but he's not accepting them. And again, as I've said, don't lose heart here, because that is for us to hear. There's a story Jung tells of, I don't know if you remember reading it, I think it's in volume 9, one, I think, Archetypes in the Collective Unconscious, this huge dream of a theologian where, was it a white horse and a black horse? Anyone ever remember reading that? And the white is bad and the black is good, and it just throws everything upside down. And Jung said he was sitting there and he was thinking, now, this guy is never going to understand this dream. Why would the unconscious send a dream to somebody who's not listening? And he thought, but I'm listening. So I think that's the attitude we have to take here. Pauli couldn't listen, but we can listen. And what this is doing is showing that the tools we apply to art, that the art is about the time, and it's about the artist, we can also apply to scientific creation. The dreams that scientists have are as much about the evolution of their work as statements of their own psyche. Because that science is also a symbol.
And Pauli impacted Jung with the synchronicity theory.
Right.
And he impacted von Franz with number and time, which probably wasn't as complete as it could have been.
Right.
But still, it's out there now.
Right. Right. So you could say they listened.
Yeah.
In that sense, I think, you know, Pauli, like Nietzsche, was a prophet who couldn't hear his own message. Well, here's what really made Pauli mad. By the way, Pauli is going to call this development of physics that can subsume psychology the development of a neutral language. That's what's in the second paragraph there. Well, it's not really neutral at all. It's actually physics language, if you think about it. But anyway, that's his thought.
115, the second.
115, the second paragraph, the last line. Naturally, the physical images ends with Pauli called a neutral language. Second paragraph. Up one line. Yeah. Now I'll just read you this because we're going to be seeing the dialogue gets a little testy. When you bring up, this is Jung, when you bring up the subject of overburdened psychology and take as your starting point the non-psychological tendency of your dreams, see, non-psychological tendency of your dreams, so I don't have to take responsibility for that, then it must be pointed out that this is a subjective situation that can be explained in many different ways. Your dreams are physical because that is your natural language, on the principle the dog dreams of bread and the fisherman of fish. But in fact, the dream means something different. The unconscious has a tendency to confine you to physics or keep you away from psychology because psychology, for whatever reason, is not appropriate. I don't think Jung really meant either of these, but what comes now is what he does mean. I never have dreams related to physics. They are usually related to mythology. In other words, they are also unpsychological. See, he's trying to say now, they're both, Pauli, they're unpsychological and they're psychological. Just as your dreams contain symbolic physics, mine contains symbolic mythology. What this means on closer observation is archetypal theology or metaphysics. But this only becomes clear when I make an effort to find out what the archetypal symbols are referring to. In this case, what I do is translate the dream figure of the language of dream figure into the language of consciousness, thus reducing the dream meaning to my subjective situation. So he's saying you can accept them objectively, but you also have to take them subjectively. But as a metaphysician, I could also examine the dream statement for its objective meaning, which in a way is what he does with some dreams as shedding light on how Christianity should evolve. In other words, not psychologically, which would take me into the sphere one of what one might call the spirit or the mind, and from there it might be possible for me to have a sense of archetypal physics. So he says, you know, who are you, Pali, basically there.
But like you say, he says it so nicely.
He says it very nicely.
Sensitively.
Yeah. That never ceases to amaze me with Jung. The tact. And yet he could be brutally honest. He just knew this was not the time to tell this guy straight away. He would never hear it. So let's try it indirectly. Well, it didn't work indirectly either, but at least he didn't say it was because I was too crude with it. More of the same in the next paragraph, over to 116, where he mentions the objective and the subjective associations at the bottom of that first quote. And next paragraph, bringing Pali back to the subjective side, Jung is saying what's important is what you say about it, what Pali says about it. So he's not letting him get away with that. Now again, you know, for me the tragedy here is Pali has just said quantum physics accepts contradictions, and then he rejects that dreams could have both meanings. I think we'll begin to see why. I don't know if we'll get to it today. We'll see a little bit why. Let me just read you what the author says. I don't quite like the way he puts it, but as is apparent in Pali's next letter to Jung, Pali is particularly irritated that Jung insists on the subjective side of dream interpretation. I'm not sure Jung did insist on the subjective side of dream interpretation. I'd say he insisted on the subjective as well as the objective, but we take his point that Jung wasn't letting him get away with saying they have no subjective meaning. Pali writes that the statement that he has physical dreams because he is a physicist rather upset me. And that's the emotion that will not go away. He's going to stay pissed. And I really don't quite understand why he says that, why he would be upset. I don't see what's upsetting about that, but he was upset about it. Now comes his poison. Pali writes to von Franz. Since 1934, I've been reflecting on the extension or migration of physics into the subjective and psychological in my dreams. It is obvious to me that one can explain absolutely nothing about this with the old talk about the fisher and the dog. In general, I am now somewhat tired of the lack of education in mathematics and the natural sciences in Jung's whole inner circle. I still look forward to the miracle of someday finding someone who is adequately educated in mathematics and natural science, such as at the level of a student in a higher semester, and who also has the necessary maturity to understand the psychological side of my dreams. It's just crazy. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the next part's so important.
You know what I thought of, though? Just,
yeah.
You know, he's sitting there saying, okay, the observer cannot influence the results of the observation. And I, for some reason, I was thinking of that Pauli effect. I mean, he would walk by a lab and blow up things. I'm like, how can he say that when it's just so like, he just always forgets. Or conveniently forgets his effect.
And now modern physics also suggests that, in fact, the observer does have an effect on the object.
Well,
and then you have a psychological.
I'm trying to figure that out still, Tom. What he would say is the apparatus has the effect. Once you've chosen the method of observation, it's not your psyche, it's the apparatus that affects it.
But you made a choice.
You made the choice, right? But once that choice has been made, you don't influence it any further. I don't know. This is an open question for me still. How to understand that?
But also psychologically, though, the contents of the unconscious responds to the interaction with the ego, with the questioning ego, and that to me would be a complement to this. Scientific notion that measuring is the act of measuring changes that which is being measured somehow, or affects it, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely an area for future study.
Yeah. Um, 117, he talks more on the first paragraph about his expansion of physics, but the second paragraph is that sentence there, I think, is important just to see how he misunderstands. Thus, the symbolic broadening of the physical symbols came about for me, which, as I see it, can in no way be explained away as figurative. You follow what he's saying there?
Which paragraph are you reading?
117, the second quoted.
Oh, okay.
Right. The symbolic broadening of the physical symbols means that he feels that the dream images, images in dreams are symbolic, but not for his personality, but for physics. And he thinks that's a, and I think in a way it is, it's a, if it's not a new idea, it's articulating a not particularly well-known idea, that scientific invention comes out of the unconscious. And that's what that's for him what this neutral language is that the unconscious as a source of inspiration for further research in science. And the figurative would mean that it has a symbolic reference for his own personality. But Jung isn't explaining them away as figurative. Jung, we just heard him say that the dreams have an objective and a subjective meaning. Pauli is accusing Jung here of saying dreams only have a subjective meaning. And that is not what Jung said. Welcome to the distortions of the borderline. This is what they do. They hear something and they twist it. So that this fight between him and Jung is going to be based on Pauli's misunderstanding of what Jung just said.
Strikes me, Gary, that this is a defense against what Jung just said.
Yes.
That with him, he's so, if science can always go back to you're not educated enough. You don't understand. If you haven't studied this field, you can't really be in conversation with me.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear that from scientists all the time. So it's very easy to defend against it. But what's so fascinating is that if he wasn't having an affective response, he wouldn't be so mad about it. He would just let it drop.
Right.
If something wasn't being provoked in him,
right,
it'd be end of story.
Right.
He wouldn't have any desire to go back and find more or whatever, he'd move on.
Right.
Something. He's and so agitated that he's continuing to engage it.
Two more things, maybe we'll stop. Just to follow up what you said, why, I'm anticipating that next time, but just to give you a taste, we're going to see that silence for him meant stability. And so to interpret it symbolically introduces instability. And silence was his rock in chaos. That's part of it. And it, indeed, it might have been what kept him from going crazy. Who knows? The other thing is, he just says he's sick of Jung, page 116. Page 117, it's calming to hear from Jung again. Welcome to the borderline again. You know that one, what's the book, Don't? Go Away, Don't Leave Me? Mm-hmm. See, it's Go Away, Don't Leave Me. Very, very difficult.
Seems like at the very heart of it, he really wants them to help expand his physics.
Yeah.
And he doesn't care about his personal.
Right.
It's not exciting. It's not
exactly.
Essence.
Yeah.
He wants to grow his physics, and he wants them to help him.
And you know, from I don't think the author says it anywhere, but I know I've heard von Franz say it either on tape or in person, one or the other. I think I heard her say it in person. I know I've heard it, that he brought physical dreams to her, and she asked for him to help her understand the physics in the dreams, and he refused to help her. So you just see he's contradicting himself.
You think that would be, he would really go for that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But so it's just talk, what
he
said.
Maybe there was fear there with them coming up with something that he should have come up with in physics.
I think it's more that he had to keep physics objective because it stabilized him. And this is what's really going on.
Sometimes he seems like an intuitive to me.
Probably intuitive thinking.
Because he wants to look at the grand scheme, and the personal details are boring and not what he wants to deal with.
Yeah, yeah, yes.
Well, isn't there also his power drive is in there?
Yes.
I mean, you can't understand my whole field of science, so therefore I choose not to invite you into that. And that's the way I can keep my power.
Yeah, half the time. The other half the time is, why can't you understand me?
Mm-hmm. Which is, I mean, that's another way the power people do that. I mean, it's okay, now, you know, you can't understand me because I'm too complicated, so therefore you can't get close to me.
Mm-hmm. I'm so lonely. Mm-hmm. Help me. They say both things. Well, that takes us to 117. Maybe to the end of the quote. Stop there. We didn't get to 123, no surprise. I don't know how far we'll get to next time, but since we have time off, I'm going to give you a huge assignment. I'll tell you why. We're going to see the dreams move toward the feminine. Von Franz will come back in his life again. And he writes a active imagination to her, which is the subject of chapter 12, the piano lesson. Now, that is no psychology. That's just the text of his active imagination. So just read through that. It's just a story. And then the next chapter is its interpretation. So I'm not sure how I'm going to go through this with you. Maybe we'll go through the text and then we'll jump to the chapter that's the interpretation and go through it that way. So read both of those chapters. Read chapter 12, which is page 125 to 140. Is that right? Yeah, 125 to 140. It's not psychology, it's just his act of imagination. And then read chapter 13, which is 140 to 152. You'll be ahead of the game to 150. 150. So one's the act of imagination. The other is the interpretation. This act of imagination is the beginning of the end of his relationship with Von Krauts. She didn't like it, and she told him so. And he broke off the relationship. But it's important, I think, to try to understand it. So who knows how far we'll get, but you'll be ahead of the game. And I don't think it makes sense to read the act of imagination without the interpretation. That's why I'm giving you both to me. So. I meant to make a list of our meetings next time, and I just didn't get to it. I think 4 weeks in day will be the 9th? 11th?
That was the 11th.
The 11th.
I don't have my calendar.
We'll meet the 11th, no, back at the church at the same time.
2007.
Meet on the 28th, though.
Yeah, we don't meet on the 28th, right.
Of January?
Of December.
Oh.
We're skipping a meeting.
But after then, we'll meet.
Same every other
week.
Schedule.
Yeah.
I'll try to make up a list. Through, I think, right before Labor Day. Right before Memorial Day.
Memorial Day.
Yeah.
What I was going to say.
Whatever that is.
Before summer.
Before summer. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's eat.
Let's eat. Mm-hmm.